This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. With an economy in freefall, peak oil, and climate change, there's been a lot of talk about what we could do. Our guest today has already been doing it. Jason Bradford is an evolutionary biologist, a relocalization leader, and host of a California radio program called The Reality Report. Jason, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on, Alex.
We've covered so many stories, but the one that finally made me call you was something I found at theoildrum.com, that's a blog, about an alternative currency based on food. Why do that, and how does it work?
Well, gosh, that's a question that I guess we have to kind of unwind during the show, because it really touches upon so many issues. I'm basically quite concerned about sort of food security in general, and I see food security as having kind of different elements. There's the ability for people to afford food, and so people that are having income troubles feel pretty insecure about their food. But then I think about it more long-term, and I look at the dependency of our food on depleting resources. I mean, not just fossil fuels, but also water and a stable climate system. And the fact that the financial system is really, we need a really stable financial system also to have a secure food system. And so many of these things are in question now. So I hadn't seen anybody really tackle this systemically. People come at it from different angles. And so when I thought about what to do, I thought, money is something that catches people's attention. And the money system itself is part of the problem, but a different kind of money could maybe be part of the solution.
Well, sure. You know, people are putting away gold bars and such, but yeah. If things get tough and I'm wondering, well, what is this money really worth, it would be nice to know that I could get back a large bag of beans for it. Now, could you just briefly describe how this idea works?
Well, it's pretty straightforward. There are just a few sort of basic steps. And the first one is somebody will come to us and or a local store and buy what's called Mendo credits. And so by buying, it means that they give us U.S. Federal Reserve currency, and we give them a bill in return that's about the same shape of a U.S. dollar, but it is basically a Mendo credit slip, and that will have on it a face value of $10, but really what it's redeemable for is certain quantities of food. So you'll see on that credit slip that if you redeem this at from us, you will get certain quantities of dry foods, pinto beans, brown rice, white rice, triticale. And so what we do is we say, hold on to this and come to us when you want this food. So we take the Federal Reserve currency and we buy directly from farmers from as close as we can. We get this food from organic family farmers. It gets picked up from their farm, brought to our storage facilities in town, and then we basically, deliver it to central locations in town where people can pick it up. So that's basically how it works. And then what people can also do is start using these credit slips like they would, cash.
Well, it sounds to me like anybody could do this.
Yeah, it's really pretty straightforward. It's not complex. I mean, you have to basically be organized and keep track, but the math is not that hard. You sort of have to estimate your costs and then estimate how much you think you can sell of the credit slips, and then you've got to sort of market it and build up interest and get people showing up.
And I guess this is part of what people probably know about already, the Willits Economic Localization Project. But for those who don't, can you tell us briefly about that?
Well, yeah, the well is kind of acting as this group that educates the community here, you know, the city, the county, anyone who will listen really about the vulnerabilities we have on being so dependent upon non-renewable depleting resources and having an economic system in which we basically expect the rest of the world to buy what we produce, and then we, for that income, we expect to be able to buy anything they're producing that we don't make ourselves. And so we kind of call into question the sustainability of that entire model and suggest that, you know, if you want a lower ecological footprint and you want to be more resilient in the face of external shocks, that the really most important things in life need to be handled locally and at a scale that you can understand and control and manage appropriately. And so that's what our message is. And what we really do is we partner with others, organizations to make it happen. Some things we take on ourselves as a small nonprofit. But this group is really working with a local nonprofit called North Coast Opportunities to help with this Mendo Credit project. So this is a case where we helped them kind of with the ideas and getting a grant, and they're the administrators of it and really in charge of making it happen. But well, with some of its volunteer base and expertise, is in there in the process and sort of making it happen with the official nonprofit.
Well, you have been a recognized voice on peak oil, but you've also studied climate change in the tropical forests in South America. And these used to be two separate communities, the climate people in one corner and the peak oil in the other. Are these coming together now?
I think that there is a general, you know, awareness among people who think systemically and broadly that, you know, we have limits to our ability to just take things from the earth, and that could imply peak oil, it could imply water, it could imply, you know, mineral resources, it could be forest supplies, and we also have limits there's limits in the ability for the earth to tolerate our waste, and so that might mean acid rain, it might mean, you know, plastics being dumped in the ocean, it might mean, you know, saturation of the atmosphere with carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. So I think where it's coming together is among the people who recognize that, you know, we're bumping up against limits in the ability to expand the human kind of domination of the planet, and that we've probably gone overboard here. So there are still camps of petroleum geologists who study peak oil and don't pay much attention to climate, and then there are probably plenty of climatologists who are highly specialized that don't think about sort of source or, you know, resource supply limits. But then there's a lot of people, often people who are more generalists, who see that, yeah, it's the whole enchilada is the problem.
Your 2007 paper, Relocalization, a Strategic Response to Climate Change and Peak Oil, is still making the rounds on the net. What would you add now with the economic crisis?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess that when I look back at that, I think, geez, you know, I really kind of nailed it in many senses. That and I could have gone more into. I've learned a lot about the fragility of the financial system, and I hinted about that in that paper, but I really wasn't aware of how completely messed up it was. And essentially, the case can be made better now than ever. And so I guess I would probably at this time rephrase it a little bit and come from the angle, you know, whenever you're approaching a topic, it's often great to have a hook that is on people's minds at the moment. So, you know, I guess you could say that people are starting to be familiar with the idea of bubbles and of debts that can never be repaid.
And of collapse.
Yeah, and of collapse. And so you could make a good relationship now and say, look it, we have debts that are financial, but really our most important debts in the long run are these ecological ones. And the financial markers, the reason that we're having sort of, we'll have bubbles, is that we've taken on more financial debt than is possible to be repaid given limits in sort of our physical world. And the financial system didn't recognize that those limits even existed. And so trying to connect the dots that say, you know, this is not just a financial bubble. I mean, and it's largely a financial bubble, but that the financial bubble, underneath that is the fact that the reason you couldn't get a 10% rate of return on your investments is that there's, you know, you can't grow the human economy in the context of a finite planet. And so we have to really scale back. And sort of the collapse of the financial system is basically saying, you know, there's a recognition there that you couldn't just grow housing forever without more people to go in those houses, without the jobs to pay for those houses at those high mortgage rates. So I think people are learning a lot about these systemic processes and the feedbacks and the limits, and we could probably help them connect it then to, you know, real, physical, tangible world. So that may be how I might reapproach that.
Well, here's something I'm, you know, connected to that I want to check out with you. A couple of months ago, you know, I've been looking at the financial press for about 2 years, and then a couple of months ago, I started worrying personally. I put some bulk food supplies away, and then for some reason, just this past week, I felt the first real sense of fear about what is going to happen here, even in North America. Do you sense that shift towards fear where you were living?
Yeah, I do a little bit. And it's bizarre because there's, you know, the trucks still show up and the stores are still full, but there's less trust or faith that it will all hold together because, you know, we've been told for so long, you know, you go back and look at reports of, I remember talking to people and that, oh, housing prices always go up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I mean, how often did you hear that? These are assets that will never lose value. There's always going to be a demand for housing here because we have such a robust economy. And other places will have their problems, but not here. And then, you know, the same thing was said about stocks, that the stock market is the way to go if you're going to get long, you know, high rate of return over time that's dependable. I mean, it has more volatility than treasuries, but overall, you're going to want to be in there. So if you're a young person and you're starting to invest, put it in stocks and then move it to bonds and treasuries as you mature and you need less risk. Well, now we've seen that the stock market value is lower than, you know, if you look at 30 years of returns in the stock market, it's gone below 30 years of returns in the treasury bills. And so everything we basically have been told about what you should do has been just turned upside down. And so I think this then spills over to people wondering, like, geez, you know, can we really then expect the trucks to show up every day and the farmers to get, you know, get their act together and keep growing all the food that we need? So, yeah, I think that, you know, it spills over and there's generalized anxiety.
Well, once you have the shock of confidence being broken on a couple of levels, then you start to question everything. But in a way, I think people like you and I want people to question everything. That's part of finding a better way. Green 960 AM, Progressive Radio, the heart of San Francisco. This is the Radio EcoShock Show with Alex Smith, and we're talking with Jason Bradford from Mendocino County about ways to handle our economic crisis. As you know, there's this ongoing debate about whether we'll see social breakdown or even a Mad Max scenario with riots and gang crime, or a revitalization of local social communities. Now, what are your thoughts, and is there some way we can prepare for more peaceful solutions to these problems?
Well, I think actually, you know, as much as there's not much distrust right now of the government and as much as they are not really doing a whole lot to take care of the situation, you know, most of what you see policy-wise is trying to get us back to the unsustainable path we were on. But as much as that's the case, you know, these large institutions that we've come to depend upon are kind of the only ones right now who can act quickly and with enough, you know, resources to stabilize things and head us in the right direction. And so, I mean, it's very hard to admit that. And so I think that at the same time that you maybe create your own buffer, whether it be, you know, stocking up on food for emergencies, which is prudent for all kinds of reasons, also keeping open to engagement, because, is you know, we really need, I sort of think about it, it's like, well, what if 5% of people in my town get it and are ready? Well, what happens when things are really go bad? So do you have community scale resources, and have you thought about buffers beyond your own, you know, household? And if you haven't, then I don't know how much good that kind of preparation really is if we have some true long emergency or breakdown.
Right. It really just stalls things if you haven't found out where your food is produced locally and figured out who the people are that are involved that can provide all kinds of resources, how we could work together on these things.
Yeah, exactly. I know.
I know you've been doing that, and you've interviewed so many interesting people for your show, the Reality Report on KZYX in Mendocino County. Your guests are almost a guide to players in the new game. Some of them wake us up from our slumber, but others are working out models of alternatives. Can you give us some names and maybe short descriptions of people that our listeners should get to know better?
Well, I've always been a big fan of Richard Heinberg, and he works with the Post Carbon Institute. So I've got some shows, a couple shows where he's been interviewed. I interviewed Bill McKibben. He is the author of this book called Deep Economy. So that's a really good resource. There's a woman named Sharon Astick who's got a couple books out now, and she's from New York. Just a prolific blogger and writer, and run a small CSA. Has a husband and a couple, two or three children, and so she kind of knows what it's like from the perspective of having to keep a household together and kind of the practicalities of all this. So she's really, really good. Those I think probably, if you're thinking about kind of community and household scale economies and preparation, those folks are great. Matthew Stein, he wrote a book called When Technology Fails. I interviewed him recently. Sort of an encyclopedic type reference. It might be, if you're going to buy one book to get started and sort of look at various chapters and think about what this means for your life, that might be a good place to go.
Well, I'll put some links up to those people and to your radio interviews in my blog.
Well, thank you.
This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Jason Bradford, radio journalist and social pioneer. What have we left out, Jason? What else are you working on?
Yeah, I'm busy. And I'm actually started a small farm at a local grammar school. And so this is May, and my greenhouse is starting to load up with plants. It's a sunny week, so I'm thinking about, I have quite a bit of beds I've got to get ready for planting out in April, and you want to start about a month ahead of time to let the soil adjust. So, it takes years to actually learn these skills, not just growing food, but say years to learn how to cook differently so that you can use food that's whole and unprocessed and in season. And so I just say start practicing, and it's actually quite enlivening and interesting. And so I'm not bored, and I get plenty of physical exercise, and this really helps you kind of cope with the stress of what you're hearing, and actually people are really interested in this, and you make a lot of good friends.
Yes, gardening is good for the stomach and your mental health, I find.
Yeah.
We can find a collection of Jason Bradford's fascinating interviews at globalpublicmedia.com, for one. We've barely touched on the years of interesting work you've produced, and I think, Jason, just as a parting shot, as the major media falls apart, it's going to be important for independent media producers to keep networking, and I'd like to have you back on Radio EcoShock as this big change keeps on coming.
Well, that'd be great.
All right, so I'm Alex Smith. Find our past programs at ecoshock.org.
Many of today's most popular video games take place in dangerous post-apocalyptic landscapes. But are these games doing enough to prepare our kids for the actual post-apocalyptic future we will all soon face?
Well, I think they are. Studies have shown that these games are quite effective at teaching our kids skills that they'll need after the apocalypse, like finding shotgun ammo and leading elite squads of super soldiers.
But these aren't the advanced skills that they're going to need. They're going to need the more practical skills like how to build a shelter from abandoned cars, or how to find drinking water by collecting the morning dew and human skulls.
Or how to deal with depression when the sun is blocked out for 500 years by a cloud of radioactive dust.
Absolutely. Now, that's the type of knowledge these kids are going to need when their world has been turned into a brutal hellscape.
But these games don't have to be an accurate depiction of a post-apocalyptic world. They just need to teach the basic concepts, which they do. 72% of kids said that they know how to find items to barter at weapon shops, and how to use medicine packs to heal zombie bites with these video games.
That's excellent to know. The game Fallout 3 has taught my son Charlie that it's easier to kill cyborgs with a grenade than a machine gun.
The games make it all seem deceptively simple. I mean, in the future, a kid's not going to be able to kill a 6-foot-long irradiated beetle just by pressing a few buttons. And he's going to have to get down there with an axe and hack and hack and hack.
David, our kids are going to have the rest of their lives to get actual experience in how to desperately fight for survival.
Exactly. What's important is that we teach our children the fundamentals now so that they can be successful in whatever nightmare scenario that they may find themselves in.
Well, if they survive
that long. Another flaw with these games is that most kids will become mutants themselves once the apocalypse hits.
It's a huge problem.
I think that it's a chance that we're going to have to take. Playing video games all day, alone and friendless, is simply the best way that we have to prepare our children for a life of solitude in a barren world.
Yes.
Gaming the Apocalypse, that's from America's finest news source, Onion News. From their early start as a sort of anti-news sheet, these people have gone on to sweet video and a pro-looking website at theonion.com. Let's enjoy some music together. This is Joel Plaskett with Through and Through and Through. Thanks a lot for listening to Radio EcoShock this week.
Somebody's in my spot. They say the good things come.